Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Friday, January the 16th, and a very good morning to you from Bonn in Germany. My name is Mark Caldwell. On this edition of Africa Link, the Africa Cup of Nations gets underway in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday.
We do have dark horses at the Africa Cup of Nations tournament. I think South Africa is a team that have really been impressive under new coach Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba. I think they should be a team to watch.
And with memories of the terrorist attack in Paris still fresh, we ask why there has been such a tepid response to the Islamist killings in Nigeria.
The French, when it happened to them, the government came out and cried out that something is happening, and the world all came out and cried to them. But over here in Nigeria, it seems as if the life of a Nigerian is worth nothing. The government has not come out to say anything.
Stay tuned for those stories and more on this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations starts in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday, with the hosts kicking off the tournament in a match against Congo Brazzaville. There are no defending champions in this tournament because Nigeria failed to qualify, so it can't defend the title it won in 2013. No defending champions. I asked Zambian sports analyst Lawrence Lehusha what this told him about the state of African football.
This simply highlights the competitive nature of the African game. In fact, they can't in leaps and bounds. We are certainly past the time when defending champions would dominate for long years to come in a subsequent Africa Cup of Nations tournament. I can simply take you back to the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations tournament when Zambia won it. That was quite victorious. It was the fairy tale of African football that time out. And then when it came to the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in South Africa, Zambia couldn't get past the first hurdle in the group stages. So in a nutshell, what I can simply say is the competitive age of African football is certainly sharpening with every year. Nigeria, we're not really an awful lot. You will agree with me. They have quality players. John Obi Mikel, when you talk of Vincent Eneyama in goal, when you talk of all their legion of stars playing across European leagues, they're certainly a quality side. But why they failed to qualify for the Africa Cup of Nations this year, it leaves one to wonder with only one conclusion, that the African game is certainly more competitive than ever before.
Which teams are you expecting to perform well this time round?
It's pretty hard to tell, Mark, which team might just perform pretty well. Let me run you through the group. In Group A, there's Equatorial Congo, Brazzaville, Burkina Faso and Gabon. And then in Group B, there's Zambia, the DRC Congo, Tunisia and the Cape Verde Islands. Then in Group C, there's Ghana, Senegal, Algeria, and South Africa. And then in Group D, there's Ivory Coast, Guinea, Mali, and Cameroon. It's pretty hard to tell who the front runners are. I think South Africa is a team that have really been impressive under new coach Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba. I think they should be a team to watch. Congo Brazzaville were quite impressive in qualifying. They should also be a team to watch. Cameroon, they're like an eagle that certainly has new feathers, having rejuvenated themselves, discarding the old guard, you know, Samuel Etufil, Rigobert Song, and the rest. But now they have a breed of young talent, very impressive in qualifying. They had to qualify with a couple of games to spare. Cameroon said, are in for a shout. South Africa, I think, might be impressive. Congo Brazzaville, let us not underrate them. When you talk of whole Equatorial Guinea, they were quite impressive at the last tournament, 2013. I strongly feel they might go a little further because they've certainly garnered experience now that they're playing at their second Africa Cup of Nations tournament, so to say.
Lawrence Lehusha, when Cameroon crashed out of the Brazil FIFA World Cup in 2014, many people thought that the team's German coach, Volker Finke, would be sacked. But he survived. He also refused to retain the services of players whom he thought had let him down. There were howls of protest, but now that the indomitable Lions have made it to Equatorial Guinea, it would appear that Finke's strategy is working. More now from our correspondent in Yaoundé, Moki Kinseka.
Avec les capitaines, avec les leaders, on a déjà discuté que le système des primes, le vieux système
Volker Finke, popularly known in Cameroon as Finke, meaning master planner in Bamileke ethnic group languages, spoken in West Cameroon, gives instructions on how much bonuses will be paid to players taking part in the African Nations Cup.
Grande prime de participation et des autres qui ont peut-être joué deux, trois.
Finke says he suggested and got the approval of Cameroon authorities that players will not be entitled to participation allowances before any competition. He says they will be given bonuses as per the number of matches they play to avoid a repeat of the situation during the Brazil 2014 FIFA World Cup, in which players held Cameroon football authorities hostage, asking for an increase in their participation allowances. Finke says for that reason, he refused to call up 80% of the players who were in Brazil.
Just after the World Cup, it was a really difficult situation. This was a reason to make a cut with the team. And that means there are new players, there are young players. It's also a work for the future.
The list of 23 players he called up include only 8 from those who participated in the last World Cup in Brazil. He says he believes the young players can be disciplined.
He is a young player, he's learning. And when you never start with young players, then you will never have good players, you know.
The coach dropped striker Samuel Eto'o, Asu Ekoto, Cheju and Alex Song, and called up little-known goalkeepers Abogo of Tonnerre Yaoundé, the Assembly of Nancy in France, Ondua of Barça in Spain. He also called Jegwe from Cameroon's local league and Clinton Jair, among others. Finke says his faith in the group has continued after they sealed a first-phase finish in their Group D of the qualifiers following a 6-match unbeaten run. Midfielder Eno Takan, whom Finke dropped from deputy captain, told me he has been satisfied with the changes.
Objective is much more for the team. Like the coach said, it's much more important to give everything for the first match, which we're going to start preparing. And that's, I think for me, that's my objective, to give more than 100% so that we can get the first result. As long as the team is doing well, I think my personal objective is in line with it.
Wangi Bay-Sipren, a senior Cameroon football official, says there are still some finishing touches the coach needs to make in the team.
We cannot judge a team which he's been trying with many, many players. We need to have a starting lineup. But we can trust this guy. We'll have a good team.
And that report was compiled by Moki Kinseka. And we return to Equatorial Guinea later in the programme, when we will be looking at the country's human rights record as it prepares to bask in global publicity as host of the Africa Cup of Nations.
News, analysis and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
The trail of destruction wrought by the Islamist militant sect Boko Haram on the town of Baga in northeastern Nigeria has just been freshly documented by new satellite images released by the rights group Amnesty International. And in another sign of quickening interest in the largely underreported carnage, Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has paid a surprise visit to Maiduguri, capital of Borno State, which is on the front line in the Boko Haram insurgency. Amnesty says some 2,000 people died in Baga. The government puts the figure at around 150. This loss of life stirs unease in Nigeria, but apparently little sympathy or solidarity. From Abuja, Uwais Idris reports.
The continued lack of outcry on situation in the northeastern Nigeria become a major concern to many Nigerians and civil society groups. Nigerians are not happy with the way their country leadership has shown little concern, if any at all, to the increasing attacks by Boko Haram, especially the most recent one in the town of Baga that left dozens dead. This, they say, is in total contrast to how France and the international community in general reacted in the wake of the Paris attack that left 17 people dead. Dr. Jibo Ibrahim, a civil rights activist, told me people are increasingly losing faith in the government to protect them.
People do not really know what to do. People are concerned, people are worried, but there's a question of action. The level of violence by this movement is such that only the army, under the direction of a government that cares, can respond to it. That's not happening. We are not seeing that happen in the field. A lot of people have reached the conclusion that this government is not interested in resolving the insurgency.
Taisha Yesufu, a member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaigners, has no kind words for President Goodluck Jonathan's government for its failure to rescue the Chibok girls.
The French, when it happened to them, the government came out and cried out that something is happening, and the world all came out and cried to them. But over here in Nigeria, it seems as if the life of a Nigeria is worth nothing. The government has not come out to say anything, and as we're speaking right now, I don't think the government has come out to say anything about the killings in Baga. The citizens don't feel they are worth it, so they let things go. They let a lot of impunity take place, because we have had issue where the military spokesperson has come out to say, why are you crying out? It's not 2,000, it's just 150. And so that tells you what is the worth that is placed on a Nigerian life.
At the moment, it seems both government officials and the opposition are both concerned with winning the next election. Mike O'Meary, the director of National Information Center, thinks it is high time the government addressed the issue of the rampant insecurity and got more concerned about the welfare of its citizens.
When the incident started in 1999, there has been hardly any massive show of solidarity and unity of purpose by Nigeria's neighbors and the world at large, as we have seen in the France example.
With less than a month to the general elections, there is no sign to the end of the insurgency in the northeast of the country, but only hope that perhaps one day the situation might get better than it is right now.
US Idris reporting from Abuja.
Human rights.
And in human rights this week, we focus on Equatorial Guinea, where police arrested an opposition politician and a human rights activist who had called for a boycott of the Africa Cup of Nations. As we heard earlier in the programme, the tournament starts in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday. The regime of President Obiang is regularly denounced by rights groups for its brutal repression of political foes, media outlets and civic organisations, as well as for rampant corruption. This report by Antonio Rocho is read now by Christina Krepal.
On paper, Equatorial Guinea is one of the richest countries in Africa thanks to its huge oil and gas reserves. However, poverty and inequality are rife amongst the population. The country's elite has been accused of diverting revenues from the export of raw materials to private accounts. The 2013 Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index ranked the country 163rd out of 177 countries. That makes Equatorial Guinea one of the 20 most corrupt countries in the world, says Vitor Nogueira of the Portuguese section of the human rights organization Amnesty International.
Of course, the regime in Malabo is trying to improve the country's image abroad, as it has done on past occasions. But there is certainly no progress in human rights.
Amnesty International is one of the many voices that have consistently criticized the government of Equatorial Guinea for massive human rights violations. It often points out that opposition politicians are arbitrarily arrested, detained without trial, and tortured. Political prisoners have in some cases been denied urgent medical treatment, says Nogueira.
This is a very repressive, dictatorial regime that continuously attacks the opposition. The way the justice system works in the country is reprehensible. There are extrajudicial executions. Freedom of the press and freedom of expression are suppressed.
According to Amnesty International, at least four prisoners were executed in March 2014. 2 weeks later, the government officially suspended the death penalty to meet the conditions for accession to the Community of Portuguese Language Countries, of which the Spanish-speaking country is now a member. What has not changed, according to the rights group, is the fact that only the corrupt elite benefit from the country's natural resources. For Pedro Krupensky, chairman of the Association of Portuguese Non-Governmental Organizations, the soccer tournament will cast Equatorial Guinea in the limelight. This country is one of the most closed out for international journalists in the world. However, for sporting events such as the Africa Cup of Nations, numerous visas were granted to reporters and sports commentators, as Krupensky further explains.
The Africa Cup of Nations could well be a door opener, so the world can know about the human rights situation in the country.
And that report was written by Antonio Archer. Ghana is one of the more stable democracies in West Africa, but is still troubled by a number of low-level conflicts. One of them, which pits two rival towns in Ghana's Volta region against each other, has been smouldering and flaring up for decades. The conflict has killed thousands and brought the two communities close to ruin. Isaac Alechi reports.
Drumming and dancing in Nkunya in northern Volta region of Ghana. It's a day for the commemoration of the town's festival. But behind the good music and dancing lies an unresolved conflict between residents of Nkunya and their neighbors in the town of Alavanyu. For almost a century now, both towns have fought over a parcel of land. In an attempt to restore peace, series of curfews have been imposed on both towns. A resident of Alavanyu complains about the impact of the dusk to dawn curfew imposed on business and other social activities in both towns.
The curfew is disturbing us.
The curfew is disturbing us because sometimes the market women sell at night, but due to the curfew, they've stopped selling. So they are short of money in the town. The business, everything has collapsed.
Everything is collapsed.
Not even a court ruling on how the boundaries of both towns ought to be has put an end to the fighting and killings. Thousands of residents from both towns have died during the unending conflict. Now, Ghana's government is moving swiftly to see a permanent end to the conflict. At this week's peace talks, there was a final attempt by traditional leaders of both towns, with the support of mediation experts and religious leaders, to find an amicable solution. Leaders gave resounding assurance of committing to the peace talks and ending the conflict. Chief of Alavanyu, Togbiga Atakra VII.
A lot of things have gone wrong in Alavanyu. Our roads are bad, there's no development, and our image has been dented so much, and we'll wish something better comes out of this negotiation. We are ready to talk and talk until peace is achieved.
One of the institutions championing the peace process is the country's National Peace Council. Its chairman, Most Reverend Emmanuel Asante, challenged the traditional leaders and all those involved to put their assurances into action and to make the process the final journey towards peace.
And I pray that on the ashes of the past, the bloodshed will rise up and build communities that will be an example to everyone. And people will look at this and say, yes, they did this because they rose from the ashes.
The talks will see both parties signing a peace pact and embarking on massive sensitization to get their subjects and people to eschew provocative acts, but it is the expectation of Ghanaians to see an immediate end to one of the country's oldest community conflicts, and maybe this could be the magic mediation talks.
Isaac Kelechi reporting from Ghana.
Your C.
Time now for you, the listener or online user, to tell us what you think of the stories we've been covering. And we've had some very topical, heartfelt responses from you this week, focusing on a story that we continue to explore in this edition of Africa Link. Here's Abubakar Jolu and Crispin Wakideo.
So today we have decided to dedicate this segment to the very sad event in Baga, northeast Nigeria. Reports came out earlier this week that the Boko Haram had massacred over 2,000 people. Rights group Amnesty International released satellite images on Thursday showing the devastation of villages carried out by Boko Haram. However, Nigeria's armed forces maintained that only 150 people were killed in the attacks.
So why no international outcry over Boko Haram killings in Nigeria? That's an article posted on our dw.de/Africa page. We've been reporting that France, Syria, Somalia, Nigeria, etc. are countries where people have been killed by extremists. But do we view all victims equally or see every attack as equally significant, Abu?
That question that we posted on our Facebook page triggered global reactions, especially how the international media reacted to the incidents in Paris in comparison to the killings in Baga, Nigeria.
Well, let's hear some of them.
Okay, here we go. Lynn Johnston Zaidan wrote, who is in charge of the news? I point finger to the media. Nkab Chilmazai threw that question right back at us. He wrote, that is a question readers should ask Deutsche Welle or other international media.
Well, in case you're listening, Nkab, I'd like to say that Deutsche Welle was the first media house to report on the Baga killings on Sunday, and we are still following up the story.
Bashir Ruli wrote ironically, nope, the killings in Europe, even if the figure is one, are far more valuable than the lives of 3,000 Africans. Donis Kochi was quick to react to Bashir's comment. He said, I hope this is not the case. And also, he asked rhetorically, what do you think about the death of the other kinds of Europeans, like Ukrainians?
Well, I think as a listener myself and as a presenter, I would also like to know what is the most news that affects me. And at the moment, it seems to be the terrorism attacks in Baga or the Charlie Hebdo in France. These are the news that are making stories across the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that people are forgetting or should forget about the Ukrainian conflict or the Ebola outbreak, for example, in West Africa. These
absolutely,
are all important
absolutely
news that should still be
quite a lot happening around the world.
Yeah, and this is a responsibility, I think, that we should take seriously, and we do take seriously.
Yeah, indeed.
If you ask me.
Yeah. Anyways, let's take it further. Marta Martinez, writing from Medellin, Colombia, was also very blunt. She wrote, the death of four people in Europe is far more important than the massacre of thousands in Africa and Latin America. James Obeng wrote, African leaders do not even value the lives of their citizens. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I think James Obeng, again, if he's listening, that as citizens, they put these leaders in power. You have the vote, you vote for these people, you put them in power. So it's important that voters choose leaders that value the sanctity of life.
It's actually quite hard to define.
Well, it is not. If we start to look at character instead of tribe.
Like voting on issues rather than
exactly,
on tribal lines.
Exactly, than on tribal lines. I think then we will begin to elect people who are capable of actually protecting our lives and our property, and it will be different.
Absolutely, you're right there. Anyways, Michael Paxson said, my words exactly this morning. It is hypocritical of Western leaders to make such a fuss over a few French people when in Nigeria thousands have been killed and nothing. Pathetic. That's all from me.
Abubakar Jalo and Crispin Wakideo. Your Say returns at the same time next Friday, and if you'd like your views to be included, then please send them to us in a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany, or in an email to feedback.africa@dw.de. If you want to be brief, then send an SMS to country code 49160 957 59510. Before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories. The Africa Cup of Nations kicks off in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday. Police in the country have arrested two people who called for a boycott of the football tournament. We've also been hearing about low-level conflict in Ghana and hearing your views on how the world treats victims of terrorism. This programme returns at the same time on Monday. All that remains now is for me to wish you a pleasant weekend. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.